Food Talk with Michael Colomeco has been brought to you by Tento, Calavita, and Wines of Portugal.
Hi, this is Celia Cutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Well, we'll talk about that off mic. Hey, welcome. Michael Michael's Food Talk here. We're a couple minutes late. Sorry, whatever. This isn't broadcast radio, so we can do this stuff. It didn't snow in New York. It was supposed to snow. It was supposed to snow so bad. So I had three guests planned for today. Jeffrey Weiss was one of them, and he couldn't make it. If you don't know who he is, he's got a great book out there called Charcuteria. Came out last spring, and it is all about his love for the Spanish take on charcuterie. It's a great book. Jose Andres wrote the intro. It's gotten a lot of good buzz. He would have been fun, but he couldn't get a flight out of the West Coast because of the impending doom. So guest one is gone, but two great guests to follow. First guest is Ariane Degain, who is the founder, the CEO, the brains behind the woman who we can thank for bringing foie gras to America. Thank you for that.
Thank you. As well as
Maigret and all the specialties from Gascony. The company's name is D'Artagnan. If you've never heard of it, I don't know why you're listening to this show. You shouldn't be. You just shut off the computer now. D'Artagnan has been pioneers in that space of French style, particularly Gascon style charcuterie, and of course foie gras. We're going to get her story, and then the second guest, which will pick up at the bottom of the hour, is Eugenia Bone, who has been on the show multiple times. She has a book out called The Kitchen Ecosystem. That's her latest tome, and it's a great book. If you've never seen it, it's great. It's all about how to buy stuff in season, how to use it in season, how to preserve it, how to use the trimmings. It's sort of, honestly, for a woman that's never worked in kitchens, it's like a chef's take on cooking. It's really good. It's really well laid out. And she's also, as another hat that she wears, I'm not sure which one she's prouder of, she's also the head of the New York Mycological Society. And those are the people that forage for mushrooms. So she's like a mushroom expert. And I think she brought me mushrooms. Yes, I love mushrooms. I could be a vegetarian for like 3 days because I would eat mushrooms instead of meat, but then I would want meat. But I could do it with mushrooms. Ariane, welcome.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
No, it's such a pleasure. So by way of background, this year, 2015, is the 30th anniversary of your company.
Yes.
And I say that with you across the table from me because we actually go back 30 years. We were both 12, and you had just come over from France to launch. Your dad came over, and your launch party was at a restaurant called the Maurice, which is in the Parc Meridian Hotel. Christian Delouvrier, one of my great mentors and great friends to this day, he was my chef. I was his sous chef, and I remember we were like invaded. The kitchen was invaded because your dad has had a hotel or a property in Gascony for years.
Two stars Michelin restaurant in Gascony, in Auch, in the capital of Gascony.
A-U-S-C-H?
A-U-C-H.
A-U-C-H. Yeah. Yes, I've been. Great part of France. It's kind of like, I don't know how to describe it. And I love Armagnac, so it's where Armagnac comes from.
Yeah, well, Gascony and Armagnac is the same region.
Yeah.
And it's the region of the ducks, of the geese, of foie gras, of wild game.
Tons of mushrooms.
Big hunting people and hunting mushroom, hunting game birds, yeah.
And it has a funny... If you look at the lay of the land, you know, it's funny because you're kind of near Bordeaux in one way, mm-hmm. near Cognac, near Bordeaux, if you go to the west, and you're not that far from the water if you go to the south.
And yet it's the west.
The west.
Bordeaux would be just
west.
A little bit northwest.
Okay.
And Biarritz, La Côte Basque would be directly west. And we do not ever pronounce the name Cognac in Armagnac.
What is cognac? Is that
it's
bullshit?
Forbidden.
It's that stuff that they double distill.
It's forbidden by our religion. It's
owned by big multinational brands.
Totally.
Consistently mediocre at any price range. Versus Armagnac, which is a single distillate, gnarly as it gets, really wonderful. Has one more grape, Baco, that they don't use for Armagnac, because there's four grapes they can use for Four grapes for Armagnac, three only for cognac.
No, except cognac, they use only the one that pisses the vineyard, you know, the Uni Blanc, the one that makes huge volume.
You use Colombal, Uni Blanc, Folle Blanche, and Bacco.
And Bacco.
Those are the four.
Yeah.
I love Armagnac.
Yeah.
In fact, I was lucky enough, you had a restaurant years ago on the Upper East Side, and the Armagnac people, whatever they call themselves, the Mousquetaires.
The Mousquetaires d'Armagnac.
We inducted you. They inducted me. I got a little toque. What good company? Roger Daghorn was with me.
Mm-hmm.
The creator of The Sopranos, David Chase was with me. And Paul Pecot, who writes about spirits.
Yep.
Four of us were inducted in.
Yeah. Well, that was some party.
It was, but what am I talking about that for? Because it's related. So talk about you launching this company in 1985. Because the landscape was so different in New York back then. I mean, there was nobody doing what you were doing. There weren't that many restaurants to speak of. And you had this crazy idea. What was the idea? Where did it come from? What's the Del Canyon story?
The restaurants were starting because it was the first graduation, the first coming out of the chefs from CIA, from FCI, the foundation of FCI, Peter Kum School, which is now the ICE. I mean, we all started in the same time. And those young chefs wanted to be recognized. They didn't want to stay downstairs in that dark kitchen anymore. And they wanted to compete and be challenged by new ingredients and good ingredients. And so we were very lucky to be of that generation and to start in the same time. And the thing that really, the spark of that was, of starting, was that two guys came one day where I was working with a foie gras in their hands, saying that they were starting the first foie gras, duck foie gras farm
in North America. Right.
Yeah. And in the United States. There were a couple of small guys in Canada doing it. And so I got all excited because this is my roots, you know. This is where I come from. In Gascony, that's what we do. We live to eat. We don't eat to live, and we want to eat well, and we think eating is not a gratuitous to survive. Let's think about the ingredients. Let's have the proper ingredients. Let's make sure those animals are raised the proper way so that they are happy, they have no stress, so that they will be better on the plate. And that's how we started, with my ex-partner, who I bought out in 2005.
George Faison.
Yeah. And so since now 10 years, I've been alone there. And growing really fast. We opened another warehouse and headquarters in Chicago 2 years ago. And this is working so well that we're doing exactly the same thing this month in Houston, Texas. And as a matter of fact, I'm going there in 10 days to celebrate our birth in Texas. Yeah.
The early days, you were just strictly wholesale. Selling restaurants. You had no retail presence.
Right.
When did you launch the retail line?
Well, the retail came naturally. Basically, the products that we have, it's only animal protein. Okay, we do mushroom. We have one olive oil, Jean Reynaud's olive oil, because Jean is a good friend and because his olive oil is top. Otherwise, no groceries, no vegetables, no nothing like that. Only no cheese, no fish,
right.
Only meat protein. And so we specialize and we try to be the best at what we do. With that. And so at the beginning, because we had the better chicken, the more exotic quail, rabbit, different kinds of ducks, there was no demand from the consumers at all. They didn't know what they were missing. They didn't know at all. There was no demand. I mean, since World War II, rabbit consumption, quail consumption, this went all the haywire with the factory farming of the
usual American proteins.
The feedlot with the future burgers and cheap chicken logged with water and totally. So chefs were very enthusiastic about trying what we were offering, venison, wild boar, but consumers... they liked what they tasted in the restaurants, but it took a while for them to be able to have the recognition and feeling like cooking the same thing at home. So it took a while to
be able to... Yeah, that's typical. It trickles down. They see it on restaurant menus in big cities, and then it moves into the smaller cities where they're suddenly saying, oh, this is interesting. So this is what this tastes like. And then they read Bon Appetit or Food and Wine when that chef is showcased. And I always thought that these trends trickle down from the industry to customers. It takes 5, 6, 7 years, maybe a little faster these days because of the speed of social media. But and back in those days, it took a while.
I was going to say also internet helped a lot, because then people all over the United States who needed, who wanted to try to experience that kind of a product had access.
Were you one of the first to do Maigret, to do that kind of that style bird?
I believe we were the first
one. I think so, because I'm trying to remember.
And you were the first one cooking it.
No, I remember that, because I remember being, so here we are, these American-born... French trained. Most of us were CIA graduates. It's funny, last week you'd have had Charlie Palmer here, and Mimi Sheraton was out. It was a really good show. And Charlie was great, because, I mean, you're talking about that history. That was the era. So Charlie emerges, worked with Jean-Jacques Rachou.
Charlie was at River Café when we started.
And he talked about ingredients. We had almost this parallel conversation.
Yeah, he was one of our first customers. The second one who replaced him at River Café, I believe, was David Burke,
who's another brilliant chef. I mean, these days we don't think of David, because I don't even know what he's up to. He's all over the place. You know, he's doing food in Bloomingdale's. He was doing a suntan theme. But he's an amazing chef. I remember Christian Delouvrier, my chef at the Maurice, going to eat at the River Cafe when David was there and coming back and saying, this guy's crazy. Yeah. And what did he win? He won some great French award, didn't he? What was only American chefs to win that? It was
I think he went for Meilleur Ouvrier de France.
And I think he got it.
And what I remember is
that's what it was, Meilleur Ouvrier.
He asked me to go to Gascony to learn. And I sent him to my father, who sent him to other people around. And so he had a grand time touring the kitchens of Gascony, working hard, but touring. But I love his creativity.
Yeah, brilliant.
He's remember at Park Avenue Cafe when he came out with that chop of... sturgeon, was it?
Swordfish.
Swordfish. Yeah, that was awesome.
He's always been, and he's got great chops. I think these days he's just sort of lost. He's not young, he's not tattooed, he's not on television. That guy can cook, so whatever.
Yeah.
But I remember, it's funny, because I remember... To your point, like getting, I mean, of course, Christian had seen these birds before, but we're getting this duck breast that looks like nothing we had ever seen. I mean, they were almost a pound a piece, maybe 3/4 of a pound a piece.
No, 1 pound.
One pound a piece, as I remember. And then we were, the skin was that just layer of fat that was insane. It had these dimples. And then we had to score, we had to make those hash marks on the skin.
Inside,
and then when you cooked them, this was never, I mean, we knew Peking, we knew Long Island duck. This was so, and then this one, you'd saute it skin side down for 90%, flip it over a little on the meat side, on the bone side, a little, let it compose, and then you'd slice it medium rare. And I was like, what the
F? Red meat.
The skin was crispy. Yeah. You ate it rare like a steak. It was unbelievable. It was just like game changer.
It was the only red meat that came from a poultry.
Yeah.
And so because of the love of red meat in America, this took on very fast.
Well, that and pigeon, but pigeon squab, but Americans don't eat that much. That's a shame. That's one of my favorite birds.
To this day, to this day in retail, there is a lot of magret. There is a lot of confit.
Yeah. And our confit is
a real confit, meaning the leg of the moulard duck that got the foie gras. So it's a big leg. It has that flavor of that moulard duck, the crossbreed, and it's slowly simmered. I just saw that now some factory farming people are starting confit with Pekin. I'm sorry, Pekin, confit.
Totally
those two words don't go together. I'm sorry.
So I learned confit from Christian, because we would buy your whole birds and take them apart, or buy your legs. I don't remember how we did it. And it was great. I mean, it was you'd marinate the birds overnight, salt, pepper, thyme, to pull a little bit of the moisture out of them. And then we would you sold goose fat. I mean, that was another thing that D'Artagnan sold. Duck fat. Yeah. We don't have goose here.
Yeah.
But you clean duck fat. And I remember just setting up this rondo of duck fat to a certain temperature, and then in slipping the legs into an oven real slow.
Yep.
And then it was
with the four spice and the garlic, lots of garlic. I have a little story about that. at the beginning, I would sell, when we started to go after fancy retail stores in New York, like Balducci, remember Balducci?
Right. Huge.
We would try to sell comfy, and I didn't know any better, so I sold it the way I saw it in France, which is in the pouch, in the bag.
In the fat.
We would put a little bit of fat so people could reheat the comfy. And then on the back panel of the package, we would explain, okay, you take the fat, you reheat your comfy in it, and then you use that same fat to cook your potatoes because it's great. And I don't know if it was too small characters or people don't read back panels of the label, but you couldn't believe how many letters, there was no email at that time, but how many letters I received saying, hey, the meat was not bad, but the sauce was a little greasy. So people actually ate the duck fat.
That's pretty disgusting. Yeah. Spoonfuls of duck fat. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, well, I guess people don't read labels. That's true. Yeah, that was like a revelation too. And then crisp under the salamander on the way out. You have it, and it's kind of doesn't have any color. Then shoot and then we would serve that with the salad. I mean, to this day, I mean, with this time of year, what better meal could you possibly have?
It's silky rich inside. It's crispy outside. Yeah. It's such an easy, and it's fast food.
Yeah,
literally.
Right.
Once you've done the confit, then you can keep it all winter. And
that was the tradition. Was you could keep it in vessels outdoors, submerged. Because it was anaerobic with the fat making a lid, and it was a Gascon solution for fall hunting and all winter eating until you had things
and,
in the spring
and surprise guests.
And surprise guests.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, great place. So let's talk a little about where you've moved, because the operations in Chicago and Houston are there to facilitate your wholesale business, because your restaurant business has grown.
Yes.
What are you doing in the retail space these days? Because I know you're growing there too. Is that kind of a push?
Retail, you mean direct to consumer?
Yeah, direct to
also retail.
And you're also getting in stores. I mean, there's both ways.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, let's say my guest is Ariane Degas. I'm not going to spell it. Go to the website, and Liz will have it spelled for you, because Liz is really good that way. Thanks, Liz. Ariane Degas, founder of D'Artagnan, which is D'Artagnan or something.
Yes.
Do I have it?
Yes.
That's because I didn't stop and think. D'Artagnan. You could Google them, and then you can see what you can buy from their website directly. They ship. That's a business that's grown. But you're also beginning to get a presence in stores, no? Or am I imagining that?
Yes. And something that helped a lot is our Green Circle chicken. This is a chicken that started a little bit as not a bet, but a challenge, a huge challenge, where I wanted to reproduce the chickens that my grandmother was raising for my father's restaurant. And they were eating the vegetable scraps from the restaurant. So I brought in a breed from France, heritage breed, that is minimum 85 days old before it's mature. Whereas, you know, your regular commercial breeds are, if that, 42 days, you know.
The idea with commodity everything is to get it from birth to slaughter weight as fast as possible. Feed it whatever the hell you want. Give it antibiotics in all of their diet. I mean, that's the American
put
commodity
mushy,
market.
You know, put water in there to increase the weight. And so that's not what we do. We do air chill, by
so
the
you
way.
Brought this, you brought this birds over.
So we
started breeding them.
Right. So we bred those birds. We asked we brought empty buckets to our restaurant friends. They would fill it with vegetable peelings that they knew were going to go to the so we had a chart that they put on the wall in English and in Spanish, explaining what you could and could not put in the bucket. Basically, any vegetable peeling works, bread works, nothing else. And in the vegetable and fruit, you have to avoid citrus because they're not going to eat it anyway, so it's a waste. And so we would bring back the buckets with the truck on the way back.
Because you're doing deliveries anyway. So you're dropping off to the chefs coming out of one door, and they're handing you buckets for basically recycling of vegetable trimming.
No additional carbon footprint.
Right.
The
right.
truck that were coming with the chickens
right.
were the truck that were going back with the vegetable peelings. And that went really, really well, and people got ecstatic about this. And so we created the same program a little bit modified to be able to, one, be more affordable, and two, do it in bigger quantities with more farmers around. Because as we grow, we don't ask farmers to grow more for us. We just add farmers to the group, whether it's pork or beef or chicken or ducks, so that there is always the best possible numbers per depending on the size of the farmer. So today we have this green circle for retailers, for consumers, that is a 45 days old. So it is a commercial breed. It's not a heritage breed. But that is fed from the market, Littitz, the vegetable Amish market in Pennsylvania, right near the three farms that are raising that Green Circle chicken. And so we now use also that market for the heritage Green Circle. And it's great because at the end of the day at that market, you have all those ugly fruits and vegetables that nobody wants. They were going to waste. Now we pick them up. We have a machine that coarsely cut it up, and we feed the chickens like that. Yeah.
And so in the New York Metro, where can people find? What stores are you in? Citarella?
Yes, Fairway,
right.
Even D'Agostino.
A supermarket.
Yeah. But of course, Dine De Luca, you know, the...
But not Whole Foods yet.
Well, Whole Foods, we have a big...
Because of the foie gras?
Yeah. I don't like the way they...
Yeah, you don't have to say it. We'd all feel the same way.
They make their money on meat, so why... I mean...
Well, you know, they make their money on meat, and it's not a secret that a while back... You know, Whole Foods is a funny place because I'll give them a lot of credit. They grew in a space which is retail groceries, where growth is profits are next to none. Growth is 1-2% a year. They've grown at 10% a year almost.
On the other hand, they're not stupid people. Yeah.
And they go to the bottom line. They make a ton of money. So a while back, the guys, you know, Tyson. Tyson owns everything. Tyson owns Iowa Beef now. A while back, Tyson went and said, look, where are you getting your chickens from? What are you paying? What makes them special? We can do that for less. So when you go in and you buy a Whole Foods chicken now, that's Whole Foods brand, it's a Tyson bird. And their organic meat, the Whole Foods meat that they're selling is IBP meat, which is kind of funny. Because maybe slightly different protocol, maybe it's coming off a slightly different lot. But this is no way, shape, and form the kind of thing you're doing. This isn't free range animals that are sort of no. These are the kind of the bad guys who. I mean, if you think Tyson Foods is so big, their marketing department are guys coming out of Harvard, Yale, the Wharton School, University of Pitt. They're not stupid. They figure, okay, hey, well, there's all this market for all this quote clean stuff, and the rules are so murky. Let's fill that void. Somebody else is going to do it. Let's do it ourselves.
There is now two ways of calling free range. You know, there is the cheap way of doing it in quantities and the right way. And I mean, philosophically, it's very. We think about that constantly at D'Artagnan because we want to grow, but in the same time, we don't want to compromise on the quality. And so it's very, it's a very conscious decision to understand each farmer capacity, not to outgrow it, and to add a farmer instead of growing the quantities of the existing ones. And so we need to have pristine forecasts, which is very difficult when you open in Chicago, in Houston, sometimes you don't know exactly where it's going to go. But it's very important, and also it's very important to keep those farmers happy. So we don't pay the commodity price, we pay the set price, set in advance, understanding, being totally transparent about the real cost of grain, the real cost of growing them, and the margin that they need to do. So they never are in a situation where... They are very often on the commodity factory farm market, where sometimes they raise animals just to realize that they're going to have to sell them for less than what it costs them to raise them.
Tyson
that,
puts people out of business all the time because that's how they do. It's contract farming. And if you bore down and you get the stories of the – it's all around the country. I live in South Jersey when I'm not here in Delaware, which is right across the river. Delaware actually has a pretty big chicken industry for whatever reason. I don't know. And a lot of them are Tyson-run farms. And, boy, they skin those farmers to nothing. They just basically set a price. Here's you have to buy this feed. You have to buy these birds. Here's the price you're going to get, and it's subsistence living at best.
At the end of the day, it's you and people like you who are educating the consumer, and it's up to the consumer to make all of us understand that they got it and that they are not going to buy something that was raised in a factory farmed manner, and that they want to be conscious of what they eat. You are what you eat. So
you are, and as Americans, we're slowly getting there. And it's funny, I mean, because we could go on. I mean, there's a million shows on this network now that attack the whole world of food and farming from all sorts of angles. But my advice has always been, when I used to do the radio at WOR, is, you know, buy better protein. Just eat less of it. Just cut your portion size down. Americans have just gotten spoiled. Food is so cheap here. And you know, you're from France. I started traveling to Europe yearly multiple times since the 80s. And I remember the first time I was looking at what a poulet de Bresse cost in France. Fucking bird was expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, right? America, you pay $5 for a chicken. You go over there, it's like $25 for a chicken. But it feeds four people very well. And if you divide that, and it's a beautiful bird, and it's really special, and it tastes great, and it's sustainable. So I think...
And it had a long life. The cost of a chicken, when you look at the chicken, the cost of it is the food that you put in it. So the longer the life of the chicken, so 120 days old chicken, which is a minimum for breast, is certainly not going to cost the same as a 35 days old chicken that is barely mature before it goes to slaughter.
And full of, we don't even know what. I mean, we know they're full of hormones. We know what our government allows. Yeah, so my advice has always been just cut your protein sizes down, eat more vegetables and side dishes, and just buy good protein. Eating well is never going to be less expensive. It's going to be more expensive. But if you look at a steak, I don't need a pound. I don't even necessarily need a half a pound. I could have a beautiful cut of meat that's 5 or 6 ounces, and it's great. That's enough.
And I would argue that it is less expensive on the long run because your medical bill will go down. I promise you that.
It's great. So, what is your website? Spell it out for people that listen. And we're going to have all of this stuff. That's why Liz is here, and the people that run this are great because they'll post all this on the website. But D...
www.d'artagnan, and that's DARTAGNAN.com.
Great, great. 30-year anniversary.
30 years. In September, big party. You better be here.
I better be there.
Yeah.
And you still have that great, I am always doing something when you have it. The Duckathon, is that still an event
Duckathlon,
you do every year?
So because of the 30th anniversary, the Duckathlon is going to be that same week. Also
in September.
Last weekend of September, the whole French community of New York is organizing something called Best of France, where we're going to try to show all our cultural and food and cosmetics and innovation and fashion heritage. And I'm going to try to do a cassoulet war also that week.
Because you've done that too, the cassoulet competition, the cassoulet cook-offs.
Yeah, and we had a lot of fun doing that. So yeah, that's going to be a heavy week, the last week of September.
Good. I come back from the beach around that time. It's about when I decide it's time to get back to work again.
Good timing.
Doing nothing for July and August. Count me in. Let's do that in September. That'll be fun. I'd love to be a part of it.
Super.
Ariane, congratulations. It's so fun.
Thank you.
Years, who knew? And you were really sort of at the point of the sword in terms of bringing those great, the beginning of bringing those great ingredients for a generation of American chefs and French chefs and all chefs alike, but we were for us to have access to things we'd never played with before. It was like a new box of crayons. I mean, that's what it was like, whoa, you know, magret de canard, foie gras, really? No shit. So we all thank you for that, too. It's been great, great, great run. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's thanks to people like you. That
No. It's you. You do the work. We're just cheerleaders. I just raise pom-poms and sit down. My guest has been Ariane again. She's great. The company's D'Artagnan. Google them. It is a great source for superb ingredients. It's a great story. She's a great story. Eugenia Bone will be my next guest in a couple of minutes. We're going to talk about a big mushroom dinner that they're having. So if you like mushrooms, stay tuned. If you don't, tune in a couple of weeks when I come back from the Philippines and I talk about something else. We'll be right back after these spots. So if you want to make a great tomato sauce, where do you start? You start with great canned tomatoes. And what are the best? What's the gold standard? What do the best Italian restaurants use, you think? San Marzano tomatoes from southern Italy. You know, I've heard of San Marzano tomatoes, loved them, heard the whole legend thing, knew they were delicious, but I wanted to go visit the region. So sometime back, I don't know, 06, 07, we went to San Marzano in the middle of the packing season in August. They've got a really long growing season. Starts early spring, April, May, and runs all the way through October because the weather down there is beautiful. You're along the coastline of Naples there in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius. And these are really small family farms, really small, like a half an acre apiece. And that's how they make a living, is harvesting these tomatoes. But what makes them great is the typicity of everything, the style of the tomato. It's kind of a long tomato with a really thin skin, super fleshy, super sweet tasting off the vine. We can Cento San Marzano tomatoes in the prime of the season, which is August. They just slow production down, handpick everything. Those little basil leaves, yeah, they're all put in there by hand as well. It is the best canned tomato I've ever had, and you're going to love them too. There's a reason chefs love these things. They're San Marzano authorized from the beginning. The factory gets inspected every year. Hey, you want to make great tomato sauce at home? Start with great tomatoes. Cento San Marzano. That's what I use. Hey, folks, Mike Colomeco here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use, you know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, you know, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy, but what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just spot on price. It's commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants wherever I was hanging my chef's toque. And that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. So my first trip to Portugal was 2013. It was a wine trip. A bunch of us flew over and toured the country top to bottom. Fell in love with the place. The food, the wine, the scenery, everything. Had to come back, which I did in 14 to film. And this time, 8 days in country, top to bottom again. Food, wine, surfing, what's not to love? If you've never been to Portugal, it's an extraordinary place. Buffered on one side by the Atlantic Ocean, you've got great seafood, great wines growing in all those regions. You go a little inland, you've got more great food, incredible wine country. Of course, Port is the birthplace of ports up the Douro. But my takeaway was, I thought I'd had a lot of varietals. I could keep a list of 130, 135 varietals I've had over my life. Portugal has 250 of its own indigenous wine varietals. And they're killer good. A lot of them growing there for centuries. It has some of the oldest viticulture in Europe. The sparkling wines from the Bijada, the great reds coming down south from those regions. What's not to love? Crisp whites, beautiful full-bodied reds, port wine, sparkling wine. So If you're not familiar with the wines of Portugal, next time you stop by at your local wine store, ask about them. I love them. I'm drinking a lot of them these days, and I think you will too.
Hey, what's up? This is John Norris, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
Hey, that guy had a regular voice, so I don't have to do my Barry White thing after everybody else does their thing. Yes, indeed, this is Mike Colomeco, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network. I've got a couple of guests, and I'm going to let Eugenia Bone, who's my go-to person here. Eugenia's been on the show before a couple of times, maybe three. She's the head of the New York Mycological Society. Am I pronouncing that right?
You got it.
Whew, gosh.
It's been three times.
I spelled D'Artagnan right, and I got that right. The four synapses that still work are apparently in line today. So what does that mean? That means that if you're into mushrooms and you're in New York, you know Eugenia because she's like one of the lead forager badasses who goes all around the country, locally and all around the country, to get all the goodies that have been growing in America forever that we didn't know about because we didn't know about mushrooms until recently. And you also have that wonderful book that I talked about in the opening of the show when you weren't here, Kitchen Ecosystem, that I love. I love it because it's it's like that's the way chefs think.
Yeah.
Albert Kuhmann, who was one of the greatest, maybe the greatest all-around baker in America, Swiss-born, but I had him as an instructor at the CIA years ago. Wonderful man, legendary man. Albert Kuhmann always said to us young kids back then, because we were young kids back then, and we dreamt maybe of being a chef someday and having a restaurant. He says, you know, the one guy you don't want to make rich is the guy that takes your dumpster away. Meaning,
don't put
anything in the dumpster.
Yeah.
And he talked about when he was an apprentice in Switzerland during the war, as like a 13, 14-year-old, having to go, when they broke the eggs for breakfast or baking or whatever, they would save all of the broken eggshells, and he would get a little espresso spoon to go in and get that little bit of white that's always trapped because they're Swiss to begin with, and his labor was free.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, in that pile of what looked like garbage, there was probably another 6 or 7 cups of egg whites that could be turned into meringue or something.
Oh, my God.
I know.
I never heard of that.
I know.
That's pretty intense, but you know what?
But that's what your book is. It's great because it's about how to buy things in season, how to buy it in season, how to use it at its optimal, what's its best and highest use then.
Yeah.
Then, if you're peeling it, what to do with the peels, if you want to preserve it, how to pickle it, how to jar
it.
And then all the way to so like 3 or 4 lives of an apple.
Yeah.
From its core to its peel to whatever. It's brilliant.
Oh,
it's a great book.
Thank you.
So you really think like a chef, which is great. So introduce the guests for me again because I am stupid.
Well, I'm going to start out with Neil and let him introduce our chef because they're connected. So Neil Redding is a member of the New York Mycological Society, and we have this annual banquet that we do. And it's been, you know, we've been going to restaurants and something like that. Neil came up with this idea. He goes, you know, let's really break it out. Let's do something really unusual. Let's see how much our club is really into pushing the limits of mushroom mycophagy, which is what mushroom eating is called.
There's a word for that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, say it one more time.
Carnivores, vegetarians, mycophagists.
Yeah, there you go.
Is it an F or a PH?
It's a PH, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mycophagy.
You fuckers.
Yeah, so Neil is really the person who put this together, you know, and he's the one that had the vision. So please meet Neil.
Well, Neil, I have to say that I have said on record for years that I am an omnivore. And I mean, God bless vegans, vegetarians, whatever. It's a choice you can make. It's like white people's problem. You want to do that? Cool with me. I get it. I mean, it's not a bad thing, but I like meat. But I like fish. But for me to like go meat free for like a week, the only way, mushrooms.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If I could substitute multiple varieties of mushrooms for a piece of meat on my plate, I could do that probably happily for a week, maybe even longer. So that's a great idea. Mushrooms are great. So tell me about this event. So what's happening? Where is it? When is it? And then what's it?
So it's happening very soon, actually.
Like
it's
tomorrow.
It's happening 2 days from now.
Okay.
Yeah, this weekend. And it's, as Eugenia said, it's for the club, for the Mycological Society. And so it's members and guests. So it's not actually a public event, but, you know, we're looking forward to a really fun and successful event. And as she also said, it's really about doing new things with mushrooms from a culinary perspective, right? And we do have meat on the menu. You know, it's a sort of an omnivore's menu, but there's a lot that we've done with mushrooms, you know, thanks to Ben Walmer, who you speak with in a minute, and the amazing chefs he's brought together. Yeah, I think the menu's fantastic. We could maybe you can even talk a little bit about that when we
just get closer to the mic. Just pull up my closer to you. So where's the event taking place? Tell me about the space. Where's the venue? What is it?
So yeah, it's been amazingly sort of generously donated by Bulltop, which is a German sort of kitchen hardware maker. They're at Worcester and Houston in Soho.
It's very glamorous. I gotta say
it's
Worcester
amazing.
Worcester and Houston says it all. Yeah. I remember when that was a ghetto neighborhood. Now it's like trust fund punks and rock stars.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
So it's like a space where they're selling cookware. It's like one of those. So it's because they've got live gas.
Yeah, and they're very design focused. So I mean, really briefly, they if you have a house that you're building or a space you're building that needs a kitchen, you know, they have CAD stations and amazing designers that will come up with a custom built kitchen for you based on their equipment, right?
Which is how Eugenia knows them, because when she was redoing her penthouse,
that's right,
in Miami, flew them down and say, "Hey, here's my budget. It's a million."
We were bootlegging gas until 1990. So, I guess I shouldn't have said this.
So yeah, in terms of the menu, we should talk with Ben Walmer here from Highlands Dinner Club, and he can definitely speak.
So
to
Ben,
that,
tell me about the whole connection here.
Well, I guess we were introduced by Mike Lee from Studio Feast.
Yeah, right? I mean, essentially, after Eugenia sort of volunteered me, I mean, to sort of lead the charge to create something different for this year's banquet, I started. I'm kind of a recent foodie, and started meeting a bunch of people in the New York food scene, talked to a few different people, and got connected with Mike Lee, who I don't know if you know, but he's involved in investment and, a lot of other things around food systems and systems thinking. He runs Studio Industries. He runs Excel Foods, which is kind of a food startup incubator and all that. So anyway, and also a chef, he wasn't able to do it, but he introduced me to Ben Walmer, who's done with Highlands Dinner Club a whole lot of amazing events and continues to. So, and we've also actually done one, earlier last fall at Eugenia's Loft, which was fantastic, about a tenth the size of this Saturday's event.
But, so tell them what we had. I mean, it was mind-boggling. I can't even go
talk
there.
About the menu, well, chef.
Yeah, it was great to be introduced to Neil and thereby Eugenia and the society. At the time, I just recently met Alan Kaufman, who's the owner of Shibumi Farm, which grew all of these mushrooms here next to me, which is a one-of-a-kind operation in the U.S. I think he's the only domestic grower that I'm aware of who's doing over 30 varieties of this kind of quality. So all of a sudden, we're talking about elevating the mushroom for a culinary experience, and I had just met this farmer. So,
where is Shibumi Farm?
He's based out of Princeton.
In Jersey?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, he's a really smart farmer. Yeah. And
very interesting guy.
And I love the way that you're smelling all these mushrooms and having a little sporgasm over there. So
when I'm quiet, either I'm chewing or I'm thinking about chewing.
So we because of Alan's incredible, those are pia pinos.
I mean, ridiculous.
It's amazing stuff. Just opened up the floodgates for what we could do with mushrooms. And we're doing, we've got
some
craft beer on hand that has golden enokis steeped in it, which are a phenomenal product. There's none in that box at the moment, but they're amazing. They smell like grape must and cider. What did you just mention? The sausage.
Oh, lamb sausage, right?
Yeah, I made a lamb and pork pia pino mushroom sausage with some shiitake powder in it that came out. I mean, all that umami of the pia pinos and the shiitake is just exploding. So amazing stuff. We've got some of the guest chefs I brought in. HDC operates, it's really a food cult. It's sometimes it's just me if it's a smaller event. But
HDC stands for
Highlands Dinner Club.
You're going to have to, when you get done this, talk a little bit about that, because it's new to my radar.
Well,
I've not heard of him.
I'll try to, in a nutshell, I'm actually professionally an architect. This is the connection with Bulltop. So the culinary events are, in the most profane way, are just our business development for me. But it's a six-year-long rabbit hole that I've been going down that's really exposed me to more hospitality design, restaurant design, agricultural design, and all of which is near and dear because I was born on a fruit farm in Pennsylvania. So that's the background. So Highlands Dinner Club is a rotating cast of chefs, farmers, producers, other creatives like Neil and whoever kind of coalesces around an occasion. We then put together a custom event for that occasion. So Again, Alan's incredible diversity of mushrooms that he has I'll go through our menu. I should say that a couple of our other chefs are Peter Drosty of Calva Brooklyn, which is a secret restaurant in Williamsburg.
What's a secret restaurant?
This is Brooklyn. Who the fuck knows?
I'm sorry.
Eugenia, let me just say, they don't want us there.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh, no.
No.
They do.
We're too long in the tooth. I'm too gray in the hair. No, it's their party over here. There's an exclusivity. There's an exclusivity to Brooklyn.
Wouldn't it be a surprise if we showed up?
Oh, yeah.
That would be the surprise.
I think he'd love it.
It's really meant to be inclusive, actually. I mean, you know, no, we can play with that a little bit.
What? I use the word secret as a euphemism for illegal, actually. So,
that we know something about.
It's like at someone's house or they don't have a C of O for what they're doing.
Space, correct. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
There's a lot of that going on.
Yeah. So, anyway, Peter's doing a maitake stroganoff with braised short rib and fresh pappardelle and a mushroom cappuccino with lion's mane Gruyere crisp. So we've got
it's
mushrooms
very
packed.
Far out, man.
Wow.
We've got a chocolatier, Diane Pinder, who's doing chocolate covered pia pino shiitake and maitake with a red wine chocolate sauce for a dip, and we're doing some maitake caviar. We're gonna do some spherification with agar agar and create an extract and put that on faux scallops, which would be the Mongolian king oysters cut into scallops.
And may reduce your tumors at the same time.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Hey, should you have any?
Good side effect of maitake.
I'm going to try my hand at a shiitake flan and make a savory granola for that with a chaga, which is...
Chaga?
We worked with chaga at the beta dinner at Eugenia's house, and it was... I would say it was successful, although what we discovered about chaga is it's kind of unremarkable as a culinary...
As a flavor,
What is it?
The chaga is like a tumor, actually, of a birch tree. And it's used in Russian pharmacopoeia, you know, the sort of traditional pharmacopoeia.
But they make sort of teas from it, and it's used... I mean, it's indicated for dealing with certain kinds of tumors, right?
Yep,
and,
it
and
is.
Cancer and cancer reduction.
And,
yeah?
Well, for
or at least
tumor reduction, and I think it's immune system, you know, T-cell boosting and things like that, so...
My grandfather used to pull fungi off of trees that my grandmother would turn into wonderful things.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, were these like fleshy fungi?
Yes,
okay, so the chaga looks like it, you know, almost like a burl of wood on the birch. You know, it's like a big crusty growth. And it's like a mass of mycelium. It's a mass of that filamentous stuff. It's not a mushroom, actually. It's mycelium. So as I said, it's used in these...
And it
traditional pharmaceutical practices.
It tastes kind of like sawdust when you...
But it's really kind of cool, you know? It's sort of magical stuff, and if you're Russian, you just really get excited.
Fetishize it. Tell me, so how are you going to incorporate the flavor of the mushroom into the flan? Steeping?
I'm going to use... I've got dried shiitake from Shibumi, and I'm going to steep that in the liquid, I think. I'm going to see if I can get... I might supplement that with some of Four Sigma Foods shiitake powder, which is an extract from Four Sigma, who's one of our sponsors for the event, just to try to boost that a little further. So some steeping, some supplementary extract.
And, I could see that working. It could be great, like a little mushroom flan, a little mushroom custard. Yeah.
With the chaga granola... sprinkled on it for some texture.
Having no reference point to that. I'm assuming it'll be a textural thing.
Well,
it's there for the crunch.
It's essentially going to be a typical granola, but savory, and the chaga will be incorporated into that as a powder. So, or perhaps steeped in the butter or oil I'll put into the granola. So,
how many people? How many guests?
About 100 people, right?
And I got to tell you that this event, I mean, I've been doing these banquets for a few years now, or we're calling this a gathering because it's more of a stand-up, cocktail-y sort of scenario. This one sold out, and our club is bigger than it used to be, but it sold out in like a week.
Wow.
Usually they take a month or so to sell.
Why do you think? Because of the complete mushroom theme of the menu?
It's because it's, you know, the menu is just so far out and inventive and crazy and creative and, you know, it's surprising. And these are, all these people are mushroom enthusiasts.
Obviously.
Yeah,
that's what
okay.
brings you together.
Okay,
in your,
all right. Let's not like push the nerdification factor.
No, I'm going to wonder. I'm going to picture. I was wondering what they're all going to look like because I birdwatch. I live in Cape May, and if you don't birdwatch in Cape May, you're an idiot because you have ringside seats to one of the greatest migration spots in North America. Mm-hmm. And all you got to invest in is a pair of fucking binoculars and look. Shut up. Put your phone down. And so I birdwatch, and I'm like, birdwatchers are like, you don't want to know, man. It's like the sorry if all these birdwatchers. It's you know.
Yeah,
it looks like an AARP ad for people in really bad-fitting clothes. It's just old, gray-haired white people wearing way too much clothes with their like with their socks pulled up over their things and rubber bands so they don't get bit by ticks or some shit.
Well, no.
None of them are around sunscreens. I don't know what the mushroom people
not
look like,
at all. No,
the
mushroom
are just
people,
goofy.
I mean, we have like all these different, you know, we've got...
It's very diverse, don't you think?
Oh, it's totally diverse. I mean, look at Neil. He's
I know,
wonderful.
No, he
he's
could be
totally,
right. The hair, the look,
he
could be yeah, right.
So Neil's a really groovy, good-looking young guy. Then we've got you know, really older people who wear fatigues all the time. Not fatigues, like khaki all the time and vests and things like that. So, you know, and practically carry a mushroom basket around. So we, and also
group.
It's diverse in terms of the economics of the people that are there.
Because it is Manhattan, too. This is a New York area, which is an interesting thing.
It's old New York. It's not like kind of new mall-y New York. It's like old... Where you have mixed together bankers and movie directors and plumbers and school teachers. You know what I mean? It's like the whole mix. It doesn't matter. It's just people who are interested in this incredible, weird kingdom of nature. Yeah, it's nature lovers.
Yeah.
And they come in all, you know, shapes and sizes.
And I love what
and
you're doing because it gets people to do what you do. You've got to be outdoors. You've got to be hiking.
Yeah.
You got to be paying attention. Mm-hmm. You got to be looking down. You got to be looking for things.
Yeah.
You're not. So this is so. The way our culture's moved to like handheld devices and computers and Facebook, and this is like the opposite to me. I mean, I love that's why I like birding because it's like shut, listen, open your ears, listen to the sounds, follow the sound, look at that bird. What's the shape of that bird? Is that a Sharpie or is that a red tail? Is that a Merlin or a goshawk?
You sound pretty nerdy.
And then as you get good, you can kind of like, but see where it's flapping wings three times, go, I don't see that thing. No, that's you know, so. But it's fun because it gets you with the world today.
It's
people
true.
Are just instant. They just type and click and get everything they want delivered. And what you're doing is like goes back to like another way to live.
We are our origins are amateur scientists from the Victorian era, basically, where people went out and they observed nature and they contributed to knowledge. That's what we do, and in a way, that's what we're doing with our banquet too, because. What Ben's after is to really stretch what you can do with eating a mushroom. And, you know, that's why people love it. That's why our group is so enthusiastic. Because when the boundaries get stretched, you know, they're in the territory they like to be.
So, Ben, you got 100 people.
Yeah.
Tell me about physically what this kitchen looks like. I mean, a four-burner stove, a six-burner stove, a double oven.
We've got a four-burner stove. So it's
gas or
it's
induction?
It's electric, actually. So
for 120.
Yeah. Well, so
not liking it.
This is the fun of the pop-up experience or execution, I should say. It's always interesting. But you know, the Bulltop showroom is spectacular. There's three kitchens in there, but there's one that's active. So we've really planned the menu around being self-contained. Brought in our own induction burners and some portable things and tuck them away so we can execute all these courses primarily off-site, get everything 90% prepped and then execute
on-site.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's what we do. Whether we're in a professional kitchen or we're on a mountainside somewhere, it's you know, you can make food anywhere if you got some fire.
It's true. And I mean, caterers, the good ones, I just take my hats off.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that, what's her name in Chelsea Market? She's been great and she's been organic and local forever. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's the Green Kitchen, but what's her name? I'm terrible. I'm drawing a blank. But she started out in Tribeca years ago. She started out in the 80s as a kid. And she's always been committed to organic and local and seasonal, buys a lot of her stuff at the Union Square. But I mean, you know, she does these events for 250 people. And it's like, I remember catering is like, because you got to do all. It's got to be mapped out. It's like war. Like, this is what we're doing. We get up at 5 in the morning, and we start on this stuff. And then we get it really cold, really fast, and we label it, and everything's counted, and every tray has X amount on them, and then we recount. You know, it's nuts. It's all planning. I mean, I remember doing banquet work in hotels, and it's just, man, oh, man. I mean, the Germans and Swiss were great at it. The French, not so much. But Germans and Swiss are organizing. So when is the event? This coming weekend?
Yeah, it's Saturday.
It's 2 days away.
So we, you know, we've been like, oh my God, the emails going back and forth because we have to do all this stuff, like, you know, get coat racks. I mean, we're setting up this, we're catering, and we're a bunch of like amateur mushroom hunters. It's a little. For
you've
some
got to have
people, like Ben,
and
knows what he's doing.
And but
for us,
Ben said, I mean, you, Ben, have been through this a lot, right? You
yeah.
Know, if you go on the side of a mountain, we can do it in Soho.
Yeah, right? I've certainly seen crazier. We've done executed crazier situations than this, but it's been working with Neil's been fantastic, and Eugenia. But Neil's co-producer has been, you know, done a lot of the heavy lifting, and the society's really. Has been great putting things together, and I think we're in really good shape. I feel a little bit right now like I should be in a kitchen prepping, but I'm happy to be here.
You will tomorrow.
Yeah,
tomorrow early. Yeah, that's exactly. When the list starts. Yeah. I'm curious, what kind of wine pairings?
This was an interesting problem.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean,
which
so
Neil
this
solved
is,
well.
Yeah, I mean, it was the first time personally I had been through. You know, how do we deal with this? You know, it's not a bar, it's not a restaurant. You know, we got the space donated, which was huge for us. You know, both in terms of the experience of the space and keeping the price down, right? But and avoiding illegality, right?
right.
But
all
but yeah. So we found maybe you should speak in more detail of the wine. But we have a curated list of wines that were specifically designed to pair with the food, and people are all buying the wines in advance, and so
they'll breed BYO.
Yeah. Well, not exactly. That was a thought. So you know, I most of my events are in New York, a fair number in New Jersey, and then done some in Africa and Central Asia. And so probably most of the time it's fully guerrilla. But cases like this, it's a public event. It's high profile. It's also important, of course, to our sponsors that we make sure everything's above board. So I had not done a beer and wine permit in New York before, but I knew they existed. So Neil and I worked this out, did the research together, and Neil really took the bull by the horns, and we got the permit. And I brought in a wine consultant who's an old friend of mine, Tom Kobelars, who's based out of Hoboken, actually. He connected me to Lyle Fass, or brought Lyle Fass in of Fass Imports, who I'd heard of. And I'm really excited that he got on board because he's such an interesting disruptor in the wine space. And that basically got...
that's a cool way to put it.
Well, he's sort of, you know, his whole operation is based on kind of doing an end around the three-tier system and bringing wine at a lower price point than if it came through the three-tier system to direct to consumers from a curated a grouping of wineries. So that gave us access to the same thing through a distributor he works with called Vine Collective. So they're sort of this collection of sponsors for us on the wine list, which basically got us access to wine at cost for the guests, and which all is in alignment with the permit, of course. So we're above board, and we got some. I don't have the list in front of me, but there's a few Burgundies on the list.
There's some amazing
Riesling. Yeah, there's some great
wine.
You know,
the great thing about them is that they have the whole price range. You know, there's some are like $14 bottles of wine. There's a couple of, you know, $60 bottles of wine. And so there's a short list, and when we bought our tickets, you just pick a bottle from. Then there was the whole question of, you know, what if you're not a drinker, or what if you what are you going to be one person walking around with a whole bottle of wine at this event and stuff? So it became a way that we were able to introduce people to each other, to share wines and things like that. So it kind of evolved into a really, it was one problem turned out to be a solution that was better than if we had not had the problem in the first place.
It drove the interactive piece, which is really, you know, it's important for Pinelands Dinner Club. This is sort of a part of the intent is to create interaction around the table. And so I think that's a good way to put it, the way Eugenia put it, is the way the wine circumstances unfolded is going to be complementary to that, people sharing.
And I could see Pinot Noir working beautifully because, I mean, the only thing you probably wouldn't want is big tannic wines, big high-alcohol tannic wines. If you go soft, if you go low-alcohol, Pinot Noir, Gamay, some of the Italian varietals like Grignolino or Ruque would be great, just... lots of floral notes would be wonderful, and Rieslings and some whites are just rich bank shot stuff right in there.
And I wish I had the list with me. There is a French wine on the list that's a varietal that I didn't recognize. It's a
white or red.
It's a red.
Well, the French have lots of strange varietals.
Yes.
Trust me.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I'm very really excited.
When you bore down into the suburb, I've got friends that are master somms, which is something I'll never. I mean, when you bore down into like they have the same grape can have three different names from three different parts of France. Loire Valley has its own obscure stuff. The Jura has grapes we've never heard of. Yeah. I mean, it's funny.
Do you know Chris Cree?
No, I don't.
He's the only master of wine in New Jersey. He's based out of Bernersville, and I had the pleasure of working with him a few times in the last year or so. Interesting.
That's I think there's only 140 or something, 150 worldwide. In the world, it's a real wonky group.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just some discipline.
Well, you know, the wine, mushrooms are great paired with wine because, you know how you were saying that you could substitute mushrooms for meat in your diet? There's an actual, like, nutritional reason for that because the mushrooms have all the amino acids that make up a complete protein.
You so told me that. I know. You told me that.
Oh,
so it
I
makes
did?
Sense.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
I
no, so,
I
no, no. It makes sense. I love it. And also with the wine and mushroom pairing thing, a lot of times, I'm a huge wine guy. Every night for dinner, and I hang out with somebody all the time. And one of the things, it's actually you're either born with it or not. It's just it's genetic. Is if you can pick up mushrooms and wine, mushrooms and truffles. Mm-hmm. It's a very specific. Whatever the fancy fucking word is,
the
nose of wine. So I'm really good at picking up. They call it truffles are really obvious to me. Mushrooms become really obvious, and then what we call forest floor in French, or just subforest floor of just wet leaves and the soil. So the mushrooms present themselves in the nose of wine, which makes no sense because it's grape juice, and so do truffles. I mean, you will if you have that ability, you'll pick up certain red varietals and just go fuck truffles. A lot of the Italian varietals, Nebbiolo has it, Sangiovese has it.
Well, you know that brings to mind a very interesting little mushroom fact, and that is that mushrooms are a terroir critter because they're absorbing, you know, the mushroom's a fruiting body of an absorptive organism that's absorbing nutrients from the soil. The mushroom reflects the nutrients in the soil. So if the fungus is growing on mining tailings, then it's going to, the mushroom's going to reflect that. So it is likewise, if it's growing in a really healthy, diverse, beautiful, and it's going to reflect those flavors. So it's the mushrooms and wine and Vinus vinifera and fungi have a lot ultimately in common when it comes to this weird palate expression of nature.
Yeah, well said. Well said. All right, we burned up an hour. Thanks for coming in, guys. Eugenia Bone, always great to have you.
Thanks.
Welcome back. Happy New Year. Head of the New York Mycological Society. Having a great dinner this week, and you heard all about it. Stay tuned.
Join the club.
I should, were I to have more free time. Yeah, I'm off the next couple of weeks. I think 3 weeks. I'll be back the end of February. I'm going to the Philippines to film, so I'll talk about that when I come back. I've never been there before. We're going to spend at least 2 weeks in country, leaving this Monday. So we'll be back the end of the month. Stay tuned for that show. Take care, and thanks for supporting Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.